Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Gregory S. Paul, renowned dinosaur researcher and illustrator, and we're talking about his new book, The Princeton Field Guide to Sauropod and Prosauropod Dinosaurs. Greg, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, I'm glad to talk to you about it.
Now, this is part of a whole series. Is there a name for the series?
They're basically the Princeton Field Guides. And
how many titles are there?
They say Princeton Field Guide. Now, Princeton does field guides. Those are for sharks and birds and stuff like that. But these are for various groups. And the first one is the Princeton Field Guide to Dinosaurs. That's now in the third edition, which is an up-to-date version. Cool. And there's the one to pterosaurs. Cool. And another one for Mesozoic marine reptiles. Also did the Princeton Field Guide to Predatory Dinosaurs, which came out. And this is, and what I'm doing is we're splitting up the dinosaurs into the three main groups: predatory dinosaurs, the sauropods and prosauropods, and I'm currently working on the Ornithischians.
Ah.
And that particular will be interesting because, as far as I know, that's the first popular trade book on that group.
Yeah.
Before on predatory dinosaurs, the theropods, and on the sauropodomorphs, which include prosauropods and sauropods. But this, I think, is the first one on Ornithischians.
Oh, wow. When's that due out?
I'm working on it right now.
Oh, and, so it won't be like
probably won't be until early next year.
Yeah. Well, that's a quick turnaround, Greg. That's amazing. Now, in your preface, you point to how much has changed in what we know about dinosaurs in general, but sauropods in specific. I'm a child of the 50s, and I grew up with Roy Chapman Andrews' books all about dinosaurs. And everything that we read about sauropods was that they were huge with these enormous necks and long tails, but in these big bodies, they could only have survived in water. And they were just sort of portrayed as these big, not particularly bright, slow-moving dinosaurs. But a lot has changed in the last 10 years about how we think about sauropods.
Well, not the last 10 years. The revolution really started in the late 60s and in 70s. But it was kind of conflicted, even back in the olden times.
Okay. Remember, I'm a child of the 50s, Greg.
Well, this is back in Elmer Riggs. He was working on sauropods at the prior turn of the century. And he was the one saying they're land animals. And he even argued that they could rear up on their hind limbs.
Do people respond to that?
Well, you know, dinosaur paleontology wasn't really a really rigorously done science. It was kind of like opinions. And he offered this opinion. It was a good one. Because he said their limbs are like those of elephants. They're not like hippos.
Right.
And other items. And also Charles Knight, you know, the famous dinosaur artist, he did do a picture of a rearing sauropod on land and so on. But he did most of them in the water. That was kind of the conventional thing. Even Osborne, the old school guy, he was kind of back and forth, but it just became kind of the consensus. But in the 1930s, Roland T. Byrd down in Texas found those trackways, those sauropod trackways, those giant ones. And they're basically made on land. I mean, wet land, it's mud flats. He was kind of putting in water to float the tails, but the pressures of the feet into the mud were so high, it was clear these things were not being buoyed by water. And it kind of stayed that way, and then Bob Bakker came along. In the 60s, he was at Yale and then Harvard, and he was the one who started putting them on land, saying they're elephantine animals. And he did an illustration that was really at the time, like, what? And that was in Nature. And I can't remember what it was, maybe the very early 70s. He put in Nature a picture of two barosaurs walking like giraffes with their necks going vertically up from the body, which isn't really correct for that particular type of sauropod. But like elephant giraffes. And it was just like, wow. And so that... And another thing he did is he published in an obscure publication in McGraw-Hill Encyclopedia yearbook skeletal drawings showing some of them rearing up and stuff like that.
Wow.
And these are things that are almost very obscure, even a lot of paleontologists today. They don't know about this stuff very, very much. So, and he was reviving what Riggs had said. And that basically pretty quickly switched it. I remember the time being kind of discontented with that because I, like you, had grown up on the old View, and they're really big and heavy.
Right.
And I did a lot of illustrations of dinosaurs when I was a kid, usually copies of other people or partial copies and that sort of thing. But pretty quickly, it switched over. And another very important thing, Bach was involved in this and some other people, Kate Bernsmeyer, who was studied sediments that were laid down. There's the classic Morrison Formation from the western United States, which is a huge formation. Extends from New Mexico to into Canada a little bit, and from central Utah all the way to Kansas. Gigantic area. It's from the late Jurassic classic sauropod habitat. And it was kind of been assumed it was a lake and deposits and big rolling rivers like the Amazon basin. And so a great habitat for aquatic animals. But they looked at it and said, oh, the caliche deposits all over the place. And caliche deposits are limestones laid down in soils that are seasonally arid. In some places, they're sheets. In other places, they form little rolling pebble things that if you're walking on them, you can actually slip. They're so round. And that's just excluded. This is semi-arid environments, forested fairly heavily. But within the streams are braided and shallow. And also, what are you going to eat in the water? Hippos do not feed in water.
That's right. They come out at night and land.
Right. And so moose do it some, but really there are very few animals that feed in water very much. So there's just not enough. And back then it was even worse because you didn't have flowering plants. One of the earliest type of flowering plants, angiosperms, appeared in the early Cretaceous, and they're water lilies. And then you get kind of water grasses and that sort of thing. But there just wasn't that much to eat back then. So it just does not work. These things were definitely land animals.
Well, it's amazing because I can remember early descriptions. I think they called it then Brachiosaurus with the nasal on top of the head, the nasal hole, that it would breathe underwater like a porpoise. In other words, just the tip of its head would come up and it would be able to breathe like that.
Yeah, all the sauropods have elevated nostrils, and that seemed to kind of make sense.
Yeah.
There are two problems with it. Larry Whitmore and some other people showed that that's not where the nostrils actually are.
Other than that, it was perfect.
Well, it's actually, you know, it's understandable, but they did, you know, some pretty sophisticated analysis, and it turns out the nostrils are always at the very anterior end of the nasal depression, and that's still kind of on the snout, so the nostrils weren't back there. But there's the other problem, you can't breathe that deep. If you take a tube, remember the James Bond movie, the Dr. No?
Oh, yeah.
They use the tubes to breathe underwater to hide. But you can only do that about a foot or two down. You go below that, and the water pressure is too great. And even whales, when they come to the surface, they don't breathe with their bodies vertical. They exhale as they're coming up, but then when they're breathing in, they keep the body horizontal with the lungs below the surface. So that's not really workable.
Is part of the thing, Greg, that people weren't doing sophisticated morphological analysis of the bones and trying to figure out how things worked. It just seems like they just discovered the bones in the old days and then put them together and just sort of figured out analogs.
Sort of. And one of the other common problems they were doing is they were putting the sauropods with sprawling forelimbs.
That's right. The limbs were coming out from the sides.
And particularly the forelimbs. They knew the hind limbs were doing that. But again, the Roland T. Byrd trackways, they show the forelimbs they are different from modern mammals. If you look at elephants in front and back view or rhinos, their feet are falling right on the midline. And their limbs actually slope down and in towards the midline from the body, which is kind of broad. These dinosaurs weren't quite doing that, but the limbs still were pretty much vertical. They weren't sprawled out to the side.
Where was the tail? And you write about this a lot in this book. Like, have people got a more sophisticated understanding on how they're covering, in some of the species, this enormously long tail?
Yeah, we never find trackways with the tail marks for sauropods, so they're carrying them in the air.
That seems wait a minute. You're used to this, but to the average person, that seems amazing. These tails are long and very heavy.
But the necks are long, too. They're carrying those above. Yeah. They're not just dragging the necks along the ground.
I know that.
So they're carrying the necks up. It's pre-stressed. You have the elastic ligaments between the tops of the vertebrae, the neural spines. When they grow, they're constantly pulling on those neural spines together, just the elastic tissues. So you actually have to work to bring the tail down. You have to use the ventral tail muscle to bring that tail down. Same with the giraffe. Giraffe neck is normally held. Now, we actually don't know what the angle is. I went to the zoo once and just watched some giraffes for an hour. They do whatever they want with those necks, sometimes horizontal, sometimes vertical, in between. But there's some sort of level which is neutral. They're not working. And to drink, a giraffe has to pull its neck down.
Got
okay?
it.
So pteropod tails are the same thing. The one exception is the whip tails that a lot of them have, the diplodocids. The diplodocoids, actually, and the titanosaurs, those are very slender, just rods, and they probably drooped down. They didn't have anything to pull them up, so they may have drooped down from the end of the tail, but they're just pre-stressed by the elastic tissues and carried high.
Now, I want to mention for the benefit of the audiences that all these topics that we're talking about right now are in detailed analysis in this book. And there is a lot to read as well as a lot to look at, too. But there's really sophisticated information in this book about the issues that we're talking about. One of the things that always always concerned me as a person who's not a paleontologist, but who is familiar with animals, what do we think about blood pressure?
And Roger Seymour has been very big on this.
Yeah.
He's a physiologist, and I guess he's some sort of doctor. And he's saying, well, how are you going to pump the blood all the way up there?
Yeah.
Because you're talking about animals 6 stories tall, the big, really big ones. And the pressures would be insanely high. And giraffes have high blood pressures that would kill a human being. He says this is just going too far.
That's what
and
it seems like.
There was an argument. Oh, what was that guy's name? I can't remember. A person came out with arguments starting in the 90s saying, oh, no, sauropods carry their necks horizontal.
Yeah.
And this became a big thing. And he was arguing that the way the neck vertebrae articulate keeps them from going very high. So this solves the blood pressure problem. And the argument was that sauropods use their long necks to be like lawnmowers. They would just walk the necks horizontal, and then they use the neck to save energy going back and forth over the ground and eating ferns and stuff like that. There weren't grasses, by the way. The kind of grasses we see today didn't exist until maybe the very end of the Mesozoic and even limited then. There were other kind of plants. Including sedges and stuff like that. You know, we walk.
Well, do we have
these sort of things in the springtime?
Do we have coprolites from sauropods that,
yes,
that show?
Do.
And what do they show that the plants that they're eating?
Oh, mainly conifers and some cycads. It was conifer dominated back then, and cycads and tree ferns, and a lot of ground cover was ferns. Then towards in the Cretaceous, you started getting ground cover like sedges and that sort of thing, little flowering plants.
I've got to ask you, Greg, it seems like the intake has to be an enormous amount of food in order to maintain
not
a body
as much
that
you
big.
Might think.
What?
Not as much as you might think.
I think a lot. Okay, so
well,
what did
it's a lot, but the thing is that metabolic rate scale to the 0.75 power rather than remaining constant as you get bigger, metabolic rates decline somewhat relative to mass.
Okay.
So for the big sauropods, yeah, it's a lot of food. But these are giant animals. Their heads look small.
Yep, in relationship to their body.
Small. But in absolute terms, I was in Berlin in 1981 looking at their what used to be Brachiosaurus branchi, which I renamed. I was very pleased to do that to Giraffa Titan because it's not the same as the American Brachiosaurus. So that's my favorite dinosaur. And I shouldn't have called it Giraffa Titan, by the way, because it looks like a giraffe is from Africa. But that's a European Latin name. I should have called it Twiga Titan.
Why?
Because Twiga is Swahili for giraffe.
That would have been good.
Yeah. And so anyway, I was there, and I looked at the skull. But they had the actual skull. But they had put a cast up on the thing way up in the air. But they have a skull in a case, and that skull was big. And it could swallow a child whole.
Yeah.
So in Jurassic Park, those bratty kids in Jurassic Park, I so wish those brachiosaurs would be eating those kids. And, you know, they were portrayed as calm, cow-like animals. No, they're going to eat small animals. They're going to pick them up because they want the calcium and
right,
the proteins.
Right.
So they could have eaten the kids. Literally, they had the ability to gulp them down. So you talk, if you work it out, the math, it turns out you have to eat a few pounds of food per minute if you're eating, like, 12-plus hours per day, which elephants do. It's a lot, but it adds up. Per bite, it's easy. It's not a problem. It would have been not a problem for them. So, but anyway, about getting those heads up high.
Yeah.
So
what's happening to their blood pressure when they're reaching up for the tall conifers?
Well, I'll get to that, but we have to explain why we know that they had their heads held high.
Okay.
That is that these people, they did these restorations of the neck, showing them horizontal. But I said, wait a second. There's a specimen up at the American Museum of Natural History of a Camarasaurus neck. It's the only case where vertebrae at the base of the neck fused. It was a big old animal and had, you know, some condition. And the vertebrae are fused, joined 10 degrees, tilted upwards. Completely contrary to what they say. And there are a lot of specimens that are fully articulated. They're in the death pose, but the vertebrae is still articulated. And some of the neck arcs up so the head is above the back, these really long neck things. And the articulations work. Also, one of the specimens they used in the original description back in the early 1900s, Gilmore said, the neck base vertebrae are really bashed up. The illustrations don't believe them. So they messed up there. So it's now agreed by about everybody. The plotocoids, the short forelimbed ones, they did have kind of horizontal necks. They could raise them somewhat, but they could also rear up. So they could get up high. And the rest of them, their necks are tilted up. They could raise their heads very high. Anatomically, there's nothing stopping them from doing that. And if they couldn't hold their heads up high, there would be something that would stop them from doing that. There's nothing there. So, and the business about the lawn mowing thing, that doesn't really work because walking for big animals is actually kind of cheap because the cost of locomotion goes down per unit mass as you get bigger. So they're holding their heads high. So I'm now going to explain how they got the blood up there.
Yeah.
I don't know. nobody knows. I talked to Roger Seymour about this, and he said, well, I don't like this, but okay. They may have had somewhat oversized hearts.
Okay.
There is a new hypothesis that argues that there was some way they were getting around it, that kind of you shouldn't be able to in a way, but maybe they've been able not to have to have super high blood pressures through some sort of a loop system that took care of it. But I'm going to guess we may never know because you just have to go back in time, which is hard to do, and measure their blood pressures, which would be hard to do in any case, and so on and so forth, and see what's going on. And we may never figure that out.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Gregory S. Paul, renowned dinosaur researcher and illustrator. And we've been talking about his new book. It's beautiful, and it's really interesting. The Princeton Field Guide to Sauropod and Prosauropod Dinosaurs. Yeah, Greg, we should be talking about the difference between sauropods and prosauropods.
Now, by the way,
yes,
I avoided a mistake that some people do. The tendency that paleontologists do, I'm going to call this the Princeton Field Guide to Sauropodomorph Dinosaurs. And I said, no, we're not going to do that because people don't know what that name is. It's dorky. There was one book that was named, used that name in the title. It was another Princeton book, by the way, by another division, and it didn't sell very well. And I said, no, we're doing it for sauropods and sauropods. And then the editor, when he noticed that it's mainly sauropods, he said, well, shouldn't we switch the names? I said, fine to that. But this is actually controversial because the term prosauropod is supposedly obsolete because of this new phylocode thing, and you're supposed to name things only on phylogenetics and crown groups and stuff like that.
Oh.
So most people call prosauropods these days, technically. They call them basal sauropodomorphs.
Huh. I know.
And we there are debates about this, and I say, you people are damaging our connection to the public because they don't get these names. It sounds like techno jargon that you don't care about them, and some people agree. So,
in your mind, in this book, within the context of this book, what's the difference between sauropod and prosauropods?
Oh, you could immediately tell them apart if you saw one.
It's oh, like yeah.
Telling a sparrow from an eagle. The prosauropods, first of all, they don't get terribly big. Some of them are substantial, get a few tons, and they have they never get the really, really long necks. They do have slender necks, but they're also very slender.
And slender tails, long slender tails.
Yeah. The tails of prosauropods are hefty. They're long, but they're hefty. They never have whips on them. Their bodies are long and fairly narrow, and they're not very broad. Their arms look like arms.
Mm.
You know, they have fingers on them with big claws, including a really big inner claw. You wouldn't want to get in a fight with one of these things. They'd kill you real quick. They're herbivores, but they're very powerful. This is probably partly for defense.
Are they mostly bipedal, too, or they can
well,
be?
Well, they were a lot of them did have forelimbs too short for them to run on them. But others did have four limbs long enough to run on, and it could be used. And we have trackways that show both. Sometimes they're quadrupedal, sometimes they're not. Now, the hind limbs, they're flexed. They have flexed knees and ankles and longer feet and long toes with claws on them, four toes with claws on them. And these things could run. You wouldn't want to, if a Proceropod didn't like you, and I don't know why it would be that, maybe a mother Proceropod, well, actually, we don't know how much parental care out there. But if a Proceropod's after you for some reason, it'd be like a bear. You can't outrun it, and you can't outfight it. Best to climb up into a tree.
Let's go through a couple of general topics about sauropods. So we talked about diet. Do we know anything about their digestive tracts?
Big. And this is another difference.
You have a photograph, I think, of a gastrolith, right, from a sauropod in this book?
That's one I picked up myself working on a sauropod in Wyoming, at Como Bluff, the famous Como Bluff that we were doing.
Yeah, yeah.
Big rock, and there's no other rocks like that in the sediments. It's clearly gastrolith, and it's you find these around the other sauropods. So they had gizzard stones, but they're not usually in large enough numbers to be a grinding system.
Hmm.
They may have been more for. They were in the gizzard. They may have been more like activators, you know, helping stir things up or something like that. And there will be a few of them in that sort of thing. But the proceropods, they have relatively small bellies. One of the main features of sauropods is they get these giant, broad bellies. And they get, over time, they generally tend to get greater and greater. So you get the titanosaurs and the Cretaceous, which are very broad-bellied. And their limbs are somewhat broader trackway and that sort of thing, too. And they're just giant fermenting guts. One of the advantages sauropods had, go back to how they can feed themselves, is mammals have to chew. And most herbivorous mammals have to chew for a while and then swallow. Ungulates get around that by being ruminants. They can bite things off quickly and then swallow it and then chew their cuds later on. But sauropods, you know, they're not chewing because their teeth are mainly for cropping. So they can just quickly get the stuff down into their bellies and start processing it by fermentation. So that they could feed themselves with these giant digestive tracts.
What about reproduction? Let's first talk about you write about R and K strategists. Which one were the big sauropods?
Well, interestingly, they were what you kind of wouldn't expect them not to be. And modern mammals, which give live birth, a rat is an R strategist.
Right.
High rates of reproduction. A rabbit, classic case, right? At the opposite end are elephants and whales, which drop a calf every once in a while, and then intense parental care on these things for years and nursing them and all that stuff. So the case strategy is slow, or it's fast. Sauropods were like rabbits.
What? When I read this, this is like...
They laid lots of eggs every year. And, you know, a few dozen probably. Eggs weren't super big, by the way.
Really?
The biggest eggs we know of, and it probably may have been the biggest eggs ever, are the giant elephant birds of Madagascar.
Right.
They were killed off just 1,000 years ago. Ugh. And, you know, they're huge eggs, but about a foot long or something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe even more. And no dinosaur egg is that big. And that's because these giant elephant birds, they were only laying one egg a year, and they were obviously it was a predator-free environment. Sauropods were doing, let's throw these eggs out there and just try to get enough of these things grown up to then later on reproduce. And they weren't giving those nests care.
Huh.
We know some dinosaurs were giving elaborate parental care, or at least to the nests, but the sauropods aren't even tried that. And there was kind of for a while, I was bought into it a bit a long time ago, we're kind of thinking maybe sauropods are parental. But they're not. And one of the reasons is that the young are too small. When they get out of the eggs, they're tiny little things, and the sauropods would end up stepping on their young. And they also can't keep up. Going back to Texas, those trackways, there's this famous herd trackway. And for a while, this was indicating parental care. Everybody was saying this. The problem is that the smallest juveniles in that herd, the biggest ones, the biggest adults, like 40-tonners, big bruisers. But the smallest ones are 1-tonners. Okay, small compared to these big adults, but that's way above hatchling size.
That's right.
Just a few kilograms. So what was happening is the adults would lay their eggs, maybe put on some vegetation over top to heat up the eggs, then get out of there. And they would also denude the vegetation if they stayed around, because it takes months for these things to hatch. And then the young are hatched just like reptiles that get out, and they're off on their own. There are some trackways that indicate they formed little pods on their own. And then when they got to a certain size, about a ton, they could stay up with adults, keep up with them. They'd probably say, you know what? There's some adults over there. I think I'm going to hang out with them because they're defending pretty well against the theropods, against the big theropods, just to be around them. And the adults probably didn't care. And so it's not like elephant. Elephant herds,
yeah.
Some female elephants with a fair number of small juveniles, a limited number that they're really lavishing care on, or whales and that sort of thing. These were very different herd structures. They weren't the organized things that we see today. And the adults probably didn't care about the juveniles. A big theropod comes in and snatches one of them. Yeah, so what?
Yeah, because they're having so many young.
And they wouldn't even know whose young they are.
That's right. Well, we don't know that. We can't be.
The chances of that's a highly probable conclusion that we can come to.
Yeah, right.
They wouldn't know.
Now, we have literally one minute left. What's your favorite sauropod again?
Giraffatitan.
And the one that you named. The amazing thing I think about sauropods is how popular they are with the public when you think about it, and you write about this in the book, is that skeletons were used in movies like Bringing Up Baby, On the Town. One of the earliest animations, Gertie the Dinosaur, was a sauropod. And it's amazing how they've really clicked with the public, probably more than any other dinosaur, maybe the Triceratops.
Oh, no, Tyrannosaurus is the most popular.
You think so? No.
No two ways about it. I've been involved in horrendous, maybe we should talk about this.
No, we're out of time, Craig.
The horrendous thing about Tyrannosaurus and the naming of the species. But
okay, that's a whole other discussion we need to have.
Okay.
My returning guest tonight, we could talk for years about this book, is Gregory S. Paul, renowned dinosaur researcher and illustrator. And he talked about his new book. There's so much in here. The Princeton Field Guide to Sauropod and Prosauropod Dinosaurs. It's amazing. Greg, it's always a pleasure.
I enjoy it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.